From 2820 Radio in Philadelphia, it's The Build. Conversations with entrepreneurs and innovators about their dreams, their triumphs, and their challenges.
Timing. When you're an entrepreneur, it can seem like it's never the right time to hire someone to focus just on your company's financial well-being. And yet, waiting too long to get the right guidance about money can derail your plans of scaling your business. Gene Godick spent his early career building experience across a variety of industries, even leading a company through an IPO. After that, he decided it was the right time to launch a service designed to help early-stage companies get CFO-level support without having to build an executive suite. It's the story of G-Squared Partners, coming up next on The Build.
The Build is made possible with support from 2820 Press, providing business consulting and content strategy services to customer-obsessed companies nationwide. More information at 2820press.com.
It's The Build. I'm Joe Taylor Jr., joined in the studio this week by Gene Godick from G-Squared Partners. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I love the background on your business. You've actually worked in a couple of different industries, and you've even had the experience of taking a company through an IPO. Now you're actually helping startups keep their financials straight as they head toward that path. So give us a little bit of background on what you do at G-Squared Partners and how you serve those clients.
Sure. So started the business a little bit over 4 years ago with the idea that all startup emerging growth companies need expert financial help, but they don't necessarily need it all full time. And when I first started the business, it was basically a CFO for hire business. And what I learned in my first year was most of the work we were doing could be leveraged down to someone at a controller or VP finance level. So I hired someone at the controller VP finance level. And not long after that, people were asking us for bookkeeping. We started hiring kids out of school and became basically an entire outsourced finance function, a finance team in a box, if you will. And you basically pay for what you use and when you need it.
So tell me a little bit about what the resistance is among early stage startups to have somebody focusing on financials at an early phase. Why would someone not even have a CFO in position at an early stage?
A lot of times some of the resistance is cost. And I tell companies early on is, particularly before you have funding, focus on sales and product. And then when you get funding, it's a lot easier to make that, justify that investment because your investor is going to ask for it anyway. So early on, you need to have a product. If you don't have a product, you don't need to worry about finances. If you don't have sales, you don't need to worry about finances. But once sales and financing comes along, you're going to need more expertise at the finance function.
And so typically in a startup founding team, if somebody on that team doesn't have that background, it usually just falls to the wayside.
Or to the CEO who does it best, he or she does it best they can, and then they catch up later.
And so when they get to that point of catching up, tell me a little bit about the onboarding process where, at what point do you normally hear from a client? Are they in crisis? Are they on fire and they need help? Or is it more, okay, we think we're actually going to start building some revenue or moving toward an IPO. Tell me how folks find you.
So our most likely referral source is an investor that just put money in the company. So we get a lot of referrals from the venture funds, particularly in the Philadelphia and New York area, saying usually an email saying, Gene, we just invested in XYZ company. We had a total of $5 million went into the company. I want to introduce you to the CEO of XYZ company. I'll leave it to the two of you to connect. That's one of my favorite emails to get.
So I think that brings up a good point. So the investors usually drive that a little bit because they're at that point looking for that kind of accountability.
Right. And a lot of times my sense is they know that they have issues during the fundraising process, but they wait until after the process gets done and either the finance function they have is inadequate or doesn't exist at all. And that becomes the opportunity for us.
So tell me a little bit more about how you came to found G Squared. You've served in this role inside companies. You've been a company co-founder before, but at what point did you say you really had a passion for providing this service to other organizations?
My whole life, my adult life anyway, I've spent working with early stage venture backed companies. You know, when I graduated from college, I went to work at one of the big accounting firms, and I was in their small business practice, working with early stage venture backed companies since 1987. So I've always, since I graduated from college, I've wanted to do this, and I've done it my entire life, either as running a company, being CFO of one of these companies, being an auditor of the companies. But I've been around this my entire adult life, and it's a passion I have, particularly in the Philadelphia market, of trying to help companies succeed.
So one of the things I think many founders that I talk to get a little stymied by is that distinction in the roles. So walk us through the distinction between someone that's doing bookkeeping, someone that's doing accounting, and then what's really the role of a CFO for a growing company?
So I think the number one role for the CFO is being a consigliere to the CEO and helping him or her understand the financial blind spots, how finance interacts with the operations of the business and the strategy. It's also keeping the board apprised of where they are and helping driving the fundraising process if needed, helping them think through the fundraising process, what kind of capital is available, what will it cost, who are potential investors. But also being a sounding board to the CEO. I mean, one of the roles we play is we're a non-threatening voice to the CEO. I mean, it currently being a CEO and having been a CEO, it can be a lonely job. When there's problems, everyone comes to you with the problems. No one ever walks up to you and says, "You did a great job today." And we can be a voice, and we are many times the voice that you talk to before maybe you talk to your board, and it can give you, sometimes I'm a shoulder that our clients cry on. Sometimes we kick their butts and say, "Hey, you're not doing a good job here." But one of the things that we pride ourselves on as a company is that we're usually the first person they call when something goes really right or really wrong. And I love that role because it gives us a chance to provide real value to the company, as opposed to just providing bookkeeping.
It strikes me as an interesting opportunity or a void that you can fill, because that voice at the table is so important within a founding team. If someone who's a co-founder is in that role, sometimes some of that emotion comes into play. If folks are, for instance, dealing with matters about equity and who gets what, it sounds to me that you get to provide that impartial voice and you're really just looking at the data.
A lot of times, I mean, we have a couple different advantages. We work with over 30 companies from DC to New York. So we see a range of business models. We see a range of compensation models for the senior team, the sales team. We know how many of the VCs think about some of these things. So we can give objective advice. We can also give a range of advice of this is how different companies are dealing with the whatever issue you're thinking about.
What kinds of things do you hear investors raise concerns about that might not have been on founders' radar?
I think the biggest concern is, you know, one is you made a promise of X and you're falling short of X. And what companies and CEOs don't always think about is they make a lot of promises, sometimes implicit, sometimes explicit, during the fundraising process. And investors keep a list of those promises. And then invariably, sometimes we see right after, sometimes as immediate as right after the fundraise, they said, "Well, we're not really going to hit that anymore. And we're really trying to do that." And that can really get your relationship off to a tough spot. And, there's a real art to fundraising of being able to be very attractive to an investor, but still trying to under promise and over deliver is really a hallmark of a good management team is when they're out with investors. I mean, when I was on the Vertical Net IPO roadshow, I had an investment banker pull me aside who was, I was in my early 30s at the time, and he seemed old in his mid 40s. And he says, Gene, he says, just remember one thing, under promise, over deliver. If you do that, you'll always be successful.
It strikes me too, as I interview a lot of founders for this show, I'm in that mid 40s range right now. And it just feels like all of the founders I'm talking to just keep getting younger and younger and younger.
You're going the wrong way.
I know, right? I got to figure out how to do this in reverse. The one of the reasons that I hear a lot that folks get into the CEO chair at small and early stage companies is because either there's an idea or a passion that somebody wants to follow, or a feeling like they would not fit in as somebody else's employee. So I wonder, from your perspective, when you're coming in, looking at a CEO and helping them evaluate what their strengths are, how much of that stuff goes beyond just the financial? What kind of coaching or mentorship do you find yourself providing to CEOs beyond just the dollars and cents?
We do a lot about it with helping them try to prioritize. I think where teams get in trouble is when they try to accomplish too much. And instead of, I think it's only realistic you're going to be able to accomplish 3-5 big things in a quarter. And if you got a list of 20-25 big things you're going to get in a quarter, you're probably going to accomplish 2. And one of the things that we do as a business is when we run our own firm, we've subscribed to a method of figuring out the 3-5 big things we're each going to accomplish during the quarter. And we actually track them every week and we report them and we hold each other accountable. And I'm always skeptical when I see at a board meeting, and I go to a lot of board meetings, when C goes, oh yeah, we just came from an offsite. We got 18 strategic things we're going to accomplish this year. And you're like, there's no way it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And then you're not surprised 3-4 months later when they're like, well, we're not going to get any of them done.
Because lack of focus.
Lack of focus. Right. You're just spread too thin. Yeah. I mean, if you got 17 things you think are really important, then nothing's important.
Where do you think that comes from? Is that a lack of experience, or is it just trying to say yes to everything that comes along?
I mean, I think one of the CEO's most important jobs is to allocate resources, and which means prioritize. And I think people fail to really choose of what's really important. And I think with experience, you learn more. I think a lot of the younger CEOs have never had to really lead or make decisions. And so if you haven't had to lead or make decisions, it's not something you're accustomed to. And everyone thinks they're superhuman and can accomplish everything. And it's hard to get as many things done.
So in your experience, some of this may feel like for an early stage leader who's accomplishing a lot in a short amount of time, who may have heard the advice, fail fast, break things, keep moving. How do you help folks overcome the resistance to slipping into that more traditional CEO role where it may feel like the velocity is slowing down, but the impact could be greater?
Well, I have a philosophy. I'll provide advice when welcomed. So if we have clients that just want us to do the accounting or help them with a model, but they're not looking for advice. And if they're not looking for it, I'm not going to provide it. We have some other companies that CEOs will call us every day and say, I'm thinking about this. What do you think? And so when either I think it's welcomed or it's requested, we'll provide it, but I'm not going to necessarily give advice if I don't think it's welcomed.
Sure. But I think I think for you, a competitive advantage would be access to you and the advice that you can provide compared to, again, coming back to what you're doing with G Squared, the typical CFO for an organization probably makes significantly more or would need to be offered significantly more than what you charge as a service for someone that's quote unquote part-time or on a retainer. So Tell me a little bit about the benefits, the advantages that a company gets from that model compared to trying to find somebody that they can lock in.
The big advantage that we provide is because we have people at basically four different levels. And so a lot of the work we do, we're able to leverage down to people that are relatively new and coming out of school, which we can charge significantly less time for. And so a young company that's not in a fundraising mode where things are status quo and going well, they may only need 4 to 6 hours a month of senior finance people time. And so we're able to get a core finance function done, including like closing the books and doing all the other things for well less than what you would pay a full-time controller in Philadelphia or New York. And that's really the advantage is we're able to provide things at a fraction of the cost and having access to multiple levels of service while paying less than you would pay for full-time people.
And the competitive advantage you have versus a traditional accounting firm, you know, one of the big accounting firms, I would imagine it comes from your focus, your experience in the space. How does that give you a leg up compared to some of the big names that you see?
So the big names aren't really in our business. The big names, if it's KPMG or the Pricewaterhouses, they're focused on really on auditing and tax work. It's not what we do. I mean, the auditors, particularly some of the big firms, audit our work because of our clients need to be audited. What we really compete against is there's a lot of firms out there that are one or two people. There's also one larger accounting firm that offers what we do. The big advantage that we have is one is we've been able to figure out how to productize this in a way that what I call a single shingle guy has not been able to do. And ultimately, his ability to take on more work is limited by how many hours in a week there is, where we have a lot more capacity and can achieve that and can achieve servicing clients more effectively. The bigger firms, they don't have as much operating experience that we have. I mean, all of our senior people have all been either controllers or CFOs of either venture-backed companies or public companies. So we're used to the boardroom. We're used to how investors think. We're used to how bankers think. So we're able to provide a lot more perspective than particularly the accounting profession, where the accountants are thinking about getting the numbers right, but the world kind of stops for them after that. And one time we were competing against an accounting firm, and I said to the CEO and CO, I said, I know the other firm. I said, I have really one question. Who do you want in your board meetings, him or us? He goes, send me a proposal.
So thinking about as you grow and scale your business, where do you scout that talent? How do you get folks onto your team to be able to provide that level of service?
So we're 19 people today. So we've made a conscientious effort with our young people of hiring people with strong grades out of schools you've heard of that have a passion for entrepreneurialism. And our goal is to grow them and to get them into being senior people. And kind of the value proposition that we've established for our young people is we're training you to be a controller of a venture-backed company, and you'll be ready for that role in 5 to 6 years. For our more senior team, we're looking for people who have like a strong, varied background in accounting and finance, and they've been a controller or a CFO. I like people who have a good technical background, but I also like people who have been around venture-backed companies. I'm like, we'll see a lot of people that have come out that have been a division controller of a Fortune 200 company. We tend to pass on those people because they don't really have the right experience or can relate to what it takes to be a startup. And so they just see these companies as being small, and they don't really appreciate the entrepreneur for what it takes to be an entrepreneur.
I think you bring up a great point. There's one thing to presenting something to your regional VP who has a very sometimes predictable set of wants and needs. Boards can be quirky. Boards can have lots of different kinds of voices. How do you get both your people and your clients ready to accommodate all the different kinds of information requests or just some of those left field things that can show up in the boardroom?
So one of the things we try to do, particularly with our young CEOs, is right after they raise money, I always offer and say, okay, we got a board meeting coming up in 4 weeks. Let's sit down together and map out an agenda. And a lot of times they really welcome that. And we say, okay. And, you know, one of the things I try to do is say, all right, what are the three most important things that you want the board to remember when they leave? Because they're only going to remember three things. So what are those things? And we start building a board deck from there, and we can help them plan that. A lot of times since we've been brought in by the boards feel pretty comfortable. And when we say brought in the board, we're recommended to the CEO makes the decision, and we work for the, we're part of, many times we're part of the management team. But the investors feel comfortable of reaching out to us directly and often do. And so we're able to, you know, provide them the information without necessarily bothering the CEO or needing the CEO to do work to get that done.
And I think that that also flows back to the idea of getting things off the CEO's plate so they can act more strategically. What are some of the things, thinking now about folks that are thinking of starting companies? We have lots of folks that listen to this show that are pre-launch stage, just sitting at the desk right now at their job, thinking about the company that they want to start. How can they structure that for success? What can they do to avoid some of the bigger problems in that transition so that by the time they're ready to work with someone like you, they're really good to go?
So some of the advice I always give to, and we, a lot of times we work with really early stage companies where they can't pay us, and we sit there and say, we give them advice and we help them along the way, hoping they're going to get funded and they get to the point where they can really afford us. And I always tell people a couple of things. It's one, it's a lot harder than it looks. It's going to take longer than you think, and it's going to be way more expensive than you think. And so people need to be prepared for the long haul, because for every Apple iPhone, there's a million other things that just don't take off like an iPhone does. And we see companies where people, where the entrepreneur maybe has a year or year and a half of money set aside to live at a substandard level. And then that's when it becomes challenging for them, when they've kind of outlasted their savings or their spouse says enough's enough, you need to start making real money. And that begins to put real stress. So people really need to plan that this is going to take 3, 5, 7 years. It's a long haul to getting, particularly if you're developing a complicated product, you're going to need, unless you're an engineer yourself, you're going to need engineers. There's a lot of things. And so I think people are really unprepared about how long it takes to really become a success and what you define as success. I think the other thing is that we see is that there's a lot of people that think, I'm going to start this business, I'm going to sell it in a couple years. I think you really need to be passionate about why you're doing this, what you believe in. I'm always a little suspicious of someone saying, we're going to flip this. It's not like buying a house, putting paint on it and selling it. I mean, I think if you're going to get into the business to start a business, be passionate about it, about have a mission, have a cause of what you're, why you're doing it and what, why you want to make the, you know, why you want to make that part of the world, whatever it is, a better place.
It strikes me that I've heard that quite a bit from investors that I've spoken to, especially here in the Philadelphia region on the East Coast. Folks are a little more conservative. Folks are not as willing as, say, on the West Coast to just dive right in with an unproven leadership team. What are the advantages that you see for somebody that's starting something in and around Philadelphia or New York where they may have more of an uphill climb to get that capital?
So I think it's probably easier to raise money in New York than it is in Philadelphia. I mean, there's fewer angels in Philadelphia. There's just fewer venture funds. But I mean, there's an abundance of talent. There's a lot of people who want, there's a decent ecosystem here of people who want to help, whether it's accountants, lawyers, other people who want to help. It's a lot less expensive to build a business, particularly in Philadelphia compared to New York or the Valley. And so I think there's a lot of competitive advantages, particularly around here where, you know, rent's cheaper. People are just less expensive, and people just need to figure out how to build what they need. But it's definitely harder here than the Valley, where there's a very willing ecosystem of people who want to make investments in early stage companies and are willing to take a lot more risk.
But it seems that the flip side of that equation is true, too, because you may find it a little bit easier to raise funds in the Valley, but you have to get to execution much, much faster.
There's a lot more pressure out there than there is here. I think the expectations are a little less. One of the funds that we work closely with, they're looking for their companies to double in revenue every year. We have other funds we work with. They're looking for them to double every 6 months. And so it's around managing the expectations and making sure you know exactly what you're signing up for.
Now, the other side of that coin, companies that prefer to bootstrap and actually build a business based on sales and revenue, the thing that I've heard again and again, investors don't necessarily want to see you making measurable revenue fairly early because that can mess up your valuations. On the other hand, if you're a bootstrapping company, you really want to focus on sales. You want to focus on serving customers and getting that repeat business in the door. What are things that a bootstrapping founder might be able to take advantage of or might want to look out for compared to someone that's trying to raise funds?
So it's kind of interesting. I mean, we look at some of our most successful clients. Overall, they've raised the least amount of money. I would argue in some ways our most successful client is bootstrap. In terms of revenue growth, they're profitable and generating cash. And so one of the things that we see with investors and we like are exciting, there are companies that are really capital efficient. They're able to acquire customers effectively. Their margins are well managed. I think whether you're a bootstrap company or you're a venture-backed company, you should really be focusing on being efficient with your capital, being able to make sure you know where every dollar is going, and not just I know where it's going, but making sure it's prioritized. Either I'm improving the product with features that people really want to buy, and it's going to cause people to want to buy the next product or renew from you, or you're spending money very efficiently to acquire your next customer. We'll see companies that start around the same time. And all you have to do is look at how much it costs them to acquire a customer. I mean, there's three things, there's a lot of businesses around here that are software as a service business. And we really look at three things about how efficient those companies are. Where are their gross margins? How efficiently are they acquiring customers? And the third thing is how well do they renew their customer base? And if you hit those three things well, you're going to be a very successful business. And you can apply that principle to almost any business.
Sure. So thinking about applying that even to your own business, when you think about your customer base, how do you have targets in mind of how many companies you will kind of get to a graduation point where they will say, we've gotten so big, we need to now take this function in-house? Or are you really looking at just kind of spreading out lots of bets on smaller companies? How do you see yourself growing your business?
So when we first started out, we focused on companies really Series A. And what we've learned is as time has gone on, we're able to actually scale pretty well. So we have companies, we actually have three that came to us when they were doing about $1 million of revenue or less. And all three of those companies generate revenues of anywhere from $15 million or more this year. And two of those three have some of the finance function in-house, but not all of it. One of them has none of the finance function in-house. And a lot of it, I think, isn't so much the size of the business as it is the CEO's preference. We had one company that's only doing $5 million of revenue, and they brought it in-house because the CEO wanted someone to sit next to him every day, which isn't part of our model.
Sure.
So a lot of it is the preference of the CEO and the CEO's management style, as well as how strong their understanding of the finance function is. So, I mean, we have a company right now we were hired right after they raised their Series A, was doing about $1 million of revenue, doing about $1 million of bookings. Last year, they did about $12 million of bookings. They'll do over $20 million this year. They're out on the street raising $10 million now. And, it's our hope and anticipation that we'll be around for a while.
Great. Thinking about the next 10 years, how big do you think this business gets for you? How many people? How many companies do you think you serve?
We think about it, but we don't. I mean, I think what we think about is watching our people grow, watching our clients grow, and ensuring we're providing great quality service to both our clients and their investors. I think if we do those things, then the company will grow. I mean, we're starting to think about, we exclusively serve today, you know, early stage and venture-backed companies. We're starting to look at maybe we can do lower end of private equity. And I think with, you know, the right characteristics, I think we could be really helpful to the early, you know, the lower end of private equity, those kinds of businesses where they're only generating a couple $1 million of EBITDA, maybe it's a $20, $25 million of sales. I think we have an answer for those businesses that could be more efficient than what they're getting today.
Great. Well, best of luck with G Squared Ventures. Gene, thanks for stopping by the show today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of The Build. Our producer is Katie Cohen-Zonizer. Our production coordinator is Nicole Hubbard. Our production team for this episode included Amelia Lohman, Jess Ryan, Faiza Samreen, Gianna Sini, and April Smith. Podfly Productions manages our post-production, and our theme music is performed by Arrows and Sound. I'm Joe Taylor Jr.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Build. We hope you'll share this series with your friends and provide us with feedback on the iTunes Store. You can also subscribe to weekly updates and learn more about upcoming guests by visiting our show page at thebuild.biz. This has been a 2820 radio production.